This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Dame Freya Stark lived an extraordinary life. Born in England in 1892, she died at the age of 101. She was an explorer and writer. She traveled extensively in the Middle East, beginning when she was 34, and she continued traveling in the Middle East into her late 80s. She went to all kinds of dangerous places, and she often went alone. She wrote 30 books. This afternoon, we'll take a closer look at the life of Freya Stark. I invite your phone calls, listeners, for Stark biographer, journalist Jane Fletcher Jeunesse. Her biography of Stark, Passionate Nomad, The Life of Freya Stark, is now available in paperback. The book, first published in 1999, was a finalist for the Penn Martha Allbrand Award for nonfiction. It was also a New York Times notable book. Passionate Nomad is published by the Modern Library. The Modern Library has also made available a couple of Stark's books, The Valleys of the Assassins and The Southern Gates of Arabia. The books include introductions by our guest, Jane Jeunesse. Jane Jeunesse is a former reporter for the New York Times, the author of three books and a contributor to two others. She has written for many publications, including The Washington Post and New York Magazine. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. Your questions and comments are encouraged. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jane Jeunesse, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be there. Here, wherever I am.
You're here and you're there. When Freya Stark died in 1993, the New York Times printed an obituary that was three columns long. But I wonder if many people in the U.S. know the name Freya Stark or know anything about her. So I thought maybe a good place to begin would be to ask you for just some very basic information about who she was.
Well, exactly. The pity is that this remarkable woman who wrote 30 delectable books about the Islamic world is so little known. She was somebody who created an extraordinary life in those 101 years. She was, as you discovered, and as I discovered after the hardback had come out, Freya was illegitimate. And in fact, she was the daughter of a British feminist and an American from New Orleans. And I keep thinking one of these days I'm going to find who that father was. His name was, I mean, I know who he was, Obadiah Dyer, but I can't find anything about him. Anyway, they had a marvelous affair, and Freya was born. And then her mother left her father, I think because of Obadiah Dyer, and went down to Italy to a grim little town where Freya was raised without any proper education. So she was an autodidact, which is a wonderfully stern word for somebody who teaches herself. And but she was there into her 30s. She did have a role as a nurse in the First World War, and that provided her a first sense of how extraordinary war is and sort of heroism. She was in the Caporetto Retreat that Hemingway wrote about in From Whom the Bell Tolls. And she was stuck there and took, because she was fascinated by the discussions between the victorious Allied powers after they had defeated the Turkish Ottoman Empire, she decided that there would be a role for her in the East if she could learn Arabic, and so she undertook Arabic lessons, which was a really rather unusual thing to have done. And then Obadiah Dyer died. She came into some money, And she left this grim, terrible existence in terrible town in northern Italy, and off she went to Lebanon and began an extraordinary career of writing.
Your story, Passionate Nomad, begins here, there, in Lebanon in 1927, and she's studying Arabic, and you write she was 34 years old, stood scarcely 5 feet 1 inch in stocking feet, and was still extremely thin from a recent illness. Both the missionaries and the Arabs in the little mountain town where she had come to study agreed that she was perfectly charming. Few suspected that this appealing young person, so apparently unassuming, old-fashioned even, they might have said, quaint, had a will of steel.
Celeste, you picked it right out. That's Freya. She was amazing in every respect, in the fact that she could do what she did and had the courage that she had. But there was another side to her, this extremely charming and charismatic person. She was also very exploitive. She decided that anybody that came by that could be used would be used. And so she left quite a wake of broken people in her behind her. But she also had legions of admirers, including the Queen. And it was the Queen who knighted her in 1972. So when she died, Dame Freya Stark. Yes, she had a will of steel.
What was at the root of that will of steel?
I think overcoming so much, and particularly, and I know what you're driving at, it was this horrendous accident. When little Freya, with all the trouble and bad dynamics between her father and her mother decided that she was going to open a factory, and she was going to open it with a wicked count named Di Riascio, whom she had met and was probably having an affair with him as well as Obadiah Dyer. In any event, the mother and the count opened the factory, installed some new machineries, invited Freya and her younger sister to come inspect the machinery. Freya, always curious, always impatient to know, got too close to the machinery, and at the age of 13 was swept up to the ceiling of the factory, and as these horrible wheels spun, this child was caught by a long shank of hair, and the count, instead of stopping the machinery, took the child by her ankles and wrenched her free, leaving a bloodied portion of her scalp up at the top of the factory ceiling. It was awful. Freya almost died. If it had not been that somebody had managed to take her to Turin, where a young man was just experimenting with this new process, this new technique of skin grafts, she would have died. But instead, and this is just unimaginable to me, they flayed the inside of the little girl's thighs and took that skin. And they did this, mind you, without anesthetic. And they took the skin, put it on the injured part of her forehead. She'd also had most of her ear torn off and head. And in due course, after months and months and months of confinement in bed, she recovered. But that trauma was central, I do believe, mm-hmm. to Freya's life. It was an accident that occurred, obviously, at the most vulnerable period of adolescence, when a young man's sense of his sexuality, his sense of himself, his need to be reassured that he's attractive, it occurred then, and it was a violation. And so it left, of course, not only the physical scars, which she was able in due course to cover up with hair pieces and what have you, and then later cosmetic surgery, but it left these terrible psychic scars. And I think it contributed to Freya's reluctance for intimacy. She was very unwilling to get too close or let anyone get too close to her. But on the other hand, it was, responsible, I think, for this extraordinary courage. She pulled out of this. She went on. And all through her life, there was this theme of confronting death and confronting fear in order to pass through fear to the other side. And it's something that we all need to do. Mm-hmm. But Freya did it rather better.
Mm-hmm. So that explains her determination and her boldness, I think.
I think so.
And I think also, though, what is curious about her is, given the difficulties of her very complicated family life...
It really was.
She had a good imagination.
Yeah.
And she also, as you said... She was a believer in education, and she hungered for knowledge.
Yes,
so she was self-taught. So, but you know, for a woman to decide, you know, well, I think I'd like to study Arabic. No, that's a pretty curious kind of choice, isn't it?
Well, nowadays, I mean, after September 11th, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if there aren't a lot of young people
yeah.
who are deciding they want to study Arabic. But for that time. It was curious because, but actually for somebody who considered herself a British citizen, and she did, even though she had always a slightly foreign accent because she was raised in Italy, the British were rather fond of Arabs. I mean, there was a whole fascination with Arabs, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, and it was the great British traveler, Sir Richard Burton and Bertram Thomas, who discovered the empty quarter, the great Doughty, who wrote the definitive book of Arabia. I mean, those people were all British, and interestingly, a lot of them were illegitimate. Certainly, Burton was. I'm fascinated by this this component of illegitimacy because there is such an urge. Prove yourself if you are not legitimate.
Hmm.
It drove her, I am sure of it.
It's also,
she never admitted
yeah.
it.
It's also a way of hiding out without hiding out.
Exactly, yes. Yes, and she was very skilled at doing that. But she didn't put on disguises as Sir Richard Burton did in his famous trip to Mecca and Medina. Such an extraordinary thing. I don't know if one says these kinds of things on public radio, but there is a famous story of Burton almost getting to Mecca, and he went off to relieve himself as a European man. He did that standing up, and it happened that an Arab who'd sort of was suspicious of Burton's disguise and who was this strange fellow who called himself a mullah and but kept to himself very much in this pilgrimage, this caravan. Anyway, he followed him and he saw him and they looked at each other and Burton knew he had no choice and he got out the hidden revolver and shot the man dead because otherwise he would have been revealed. So Burton got into all kinds of disguises and Freya really didn't. Like so many other of the famous British travelers, she went in European dress, and partly I think that was a signal to say, I am a representative of the great British Empire upon which the sun never sets. You know, it was very important. It gave her an important identity as a woman that she would never have had, of course, at home.
Hmm. How did the fact that she was British affect her relationships with the local peoples of the Middle East? Because one of the things that she did that is so amazing is she lived as a local.
That's true. But she was always, you know, she never tried to disguise the fact that she was British.
Right.
She took pride in it, and they always assumed, you know, those were the good old days. Those were the days when... The East, the Middle East, informed by and illuminated by Islam, which is a very it's a very rigorous religion, and it's also a religion that requires a lot of conformity. In those days, there was very little thievery. I mean, you got your hand cut off or your leg cut off if you were a thief. People behaved in a way that was very there was a lot of probity, and they respected these travelers, and indeed they felt obliged to welcome them and give them the hospitality which the East has always been famous for. So Freya actually rather exploited that generosity of spirit, and when she would say later that she would go up to the biggest tent in the desert and say, "Allah has sent me," and whoever the chieftain was, he and his family would put her up, and she would stay as long as she felt she wanted to. It was quite outrageous behavior.
Pretty cheeky.
Very cheeky, but effective. And she certainly got to see places and understand a side of life that very swell travelers like Gertrude Bell. Are you familiar with Gertrude Bell?
No.
Oh, Gertrude Bell's wonderful. You'll have to read Janet Wallach's biography of Gertrude Bell. She was the first woman, British again, to be in the Foreign Service. And this is because she had traveled in the Middle East very grandly with many tents and many horses and a cooks and, you know, all kinds of bearers for her many, many trunks. Very unlike Freya, who traveled alone and drank the local water. But Gertrude Bell traveled elaborately. So when the British defeated the Ottomans and they seized Iraq as their mandate in 1920, they asked Gertrude Bell, Sir Percy Cox, who was a famous British general, asked Gertrude Bell to be his Oriental secretary, so-called. And it was Gertrude Bell who drew the lines of present-day Iraq, absorbing the Shia in the south, the Kurds in the north, the Sunni in the middle, giving them access to water, the Persian Gulf, giving them access to oil in the north. That was Gertrude Bell. She was quite a dame, and she died 2 years. She died in Baghdad 2 years before Freya got to Baghdad. And it was probably just as well, because I don't think she would have been very nice to Freya, because I don't think she liked women any more than Freya did.
Yeah, Freya, women weren't high on her her circle. No, she preferred the company of men.
She did, and the best thing that ever happened to Freya was when she was 70, her much put upon British publisher, John Murray, gave her a 70th birthday party and invited 70 men and Freya. And she felt that this was the kind of birthday party that any woman ought to have.
Yeah.
No women at all.
Well, even among her godchildren, she favored the boys.
Oh, she did. She did, and influenced them very much. I mean, one of them, who was Maggie Thatcher's portfolio holder, whatever he was. Anyway, he was a member of Parliament, and I think what do they call it? It doesn't matter. But he learned to speak Arabic at Oxford because of Freya, and so did several others of them. And one of them turned into a professor of Muslim history. Islamic history in Australia. So she impacted on her children, and even on the female children, who were always trying to get her attention, but they never could succeed as well as those handsome young godsons.
Her first great adventure took her to Damascus.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was an amazing time for anybody to get to Damascus, let alone a young woman traveling alone. She got there in 1927, and this was just after the French had put down a tremendous uprising left by mountainous people who were very secretive and quite fascinating themselves, and Freya was interested in them. But they led this revolt. It spread like prairie fire throughout Syria, and the French brutally put it down. And to this day, the Syrians consider that revolt their revolution and look back on the French as murderers and with a great deal of resentment. Anyway, so she arrived to a pockmarked, blistered, blown-up Damascus and set about to practice her Arabic. And she was visited by some young men that she was quite enamored of, who came to see her. And she lived with a shoemaker's family by the Bab Toma, where my husband and I have visited and found her little house. Incidentally, Celeste, one of the fun things about researching Freya Stark has been the opportunities that my husband Bob and even my son Tom have had following in her footsteps, teeny tiny footsteps, and ours are much bigger. But my goodness, she led us to wonderful places. And just before September 11th, we came back from Persia, from Iran, where we climbed the Rock of Alamut. And you've read now about the assassins. So that was a pretty extraordinary thing. And then, bang, there was the assassins who established the first terrorist organization that kept the Middle East in thrall for 200 years, kept it destabilized for 200 years, and was the prototype for Osama bin Laden, and Freya was the first person to write about them. And then, of course, there was September 11th. Just after we'd come home, mm-hmm. there was September 11th. So it's pretty wild. I hope that makes some sense, but I'm trying to pack in too much information.
Well, there's so much here, and I think what we're going to do this afternoon is just whet the appetite of our listeners.
Oh, you're very kind. She does develop. One does develop quite an appetite with Freya.
Yeah. What was your introduction to Freya Stark? How did you first learn about her?
Well, aren't you nice to ask? My brother was Joseph Fletcher, and he was a professor at Harvard and an authority on Central Asia and the Middle East, and he spoke 17 languages, including all the languages of these Afghani people, Uyghur and Turkai and Tajik, all these things that we're now reading about these people. And he died at the age of 49, and I was completely undone. I adored him. He was just charming. And I wanted to find out about the secret Muslim Brotherhoods. He'd been an authority on these secret Muslim Brotherhoods, of which Osama bin Laden's is only simply one, although the more scarifying. And so I read about the assassins, and I couldn't find very much about the assassins, and I stumbled on this book called The Valleys of the Assassins, read it, was undone by the language, and it was by this funny little woman named Freya Stark, whom I'd never heard of. And it also happened that I had been to college with a young man. I'd gone to Radcliffe, and he was at Harvard, and we took classes together, and this young man was named Karim Khan. In our junior year, Karim Khan's grandfather died, and Karim Khan became the Aga Khan. The Aga Khan, mm-hmm. Karim Khan, is one of the greatest philanthropists today. He's an extraordinarily rich and generous man, but he is also the direct descendant of the ancient assassins. The assassins who, like Osama bin Laden, didn't approve of either the Sunni caliph in Baghdad, nor of the Fatimid caliph in Cairo, decided that the only way to unseat these illegitimate governments was to target them, train assassins, send those assassins in secretly undercover, and assassinate the leaders of these two great governments that dominated the Middle East. That's, of course, what Osama bin Laden did, too. I mean, he's after the United States, but he's really after the illegitimate governments that we support. So these assassins terrorized the Middle East. Even the great Salah ad-Din, the great Kurdish general that united the Middle East, even he had to treat with the assassins. The assassins were in place for 185 years, and their history is totally fascinating, and now there are books coming out about the assassins. But Freya Stark's account was the first account that I had ever read about these assassins. And it was beautifully written, as I said, and so I decided, because I had gone to school with Karim Khan, the Aga Khan, who is directly descended from these assassins, and because of my brother, I would write this book. And I should say about Karim Khan that in 1250 A.D., after nearly 200 years of the assassins keeping everybody terrified and suspicious of their neighbor, in 1250, the Mongols came pounding in from the east, and they, with their giant cavalry of hundreds of thousands of horses, finally were able to drive out the assassins from their caves in the mountains below the Caspian Sea and in the mountains of Syria. But the castles are all still there of these assassins. And it's something that people, if they knew more about the history of the assassins, you know, it would make a little more sense what Osama bin Laden was doing.
Yeah. I'm wondering if people in the Foreign Service and if people in journalism are well aware of her books, and are they being read today by those kinds of folks?
Increasingly, I think. I just happened, before we came here to Florida, I just happened to be at an event in the State Department in Washington and saw Brent Scowcroft, who, you know, was Bush's national security advisor, and we had a chat about the assassins, and he was familiar with them. He was actually a little wrong about some aspects, but not in any essential way. So I think that they are, but you know what? Not as much, and probably not as many policymakers. I mean, who knows if George Bush, a young George Bush, knows anything about the assassins or Condoleezza Rice? I don't know, but they ought to. Because it's part of the history of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And is Richard Burton, whom we were talking about earlier, who'd made this pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina, as Richard Burton said, the history of the Middle East is the history of despotism tempered by assassination.
Mm.
Not a nice way to put it, but
no.
Interesting.
And Freya Stark was so aware of all of this history, and I think it's very telling that she was also very aware of the power of language.
Oh, yes.
And early in Passionate Nomad, you quote her in a letter writing home, "What I find trying in a country which you do not understand and where you cannot speak is that you can never be yourself."
Ah, yes. Isn't that? It's true. And it's always very hard not to be yourself. The quote goes on, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, and she says, and I put it in my notes here, but I haven't put the whole thing in, of course, but she was aware that when she could speak Arabic, she would be an individual, she would be a person, she wouldn't be British, she wouldn't be woman necessarily, she could be herself.
She would be an outsider.
She would be an outsider, but she would, I don't know, some of that, the difficulty of being a category rather than a person would fall away.
Well, don't you find that, you know, they always say that unless you can speak the language well enough to understand the ironies and the jokes, you don't speak the language.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was driving for a full enough command of Arabic to be able to be ironic and to be humorous, to make jokes. But to not be a outsider, a woman, a British citizen plunked down in the midst of these people that she wanted to get to know.
We're talking this afternoon with journalist Jane Fletcher Jeunesse. We're talking with her about a biography that she has written of Freya Stark, Dame Freya Stark. Stark was an explorer and a writer. She lived until she was 101. She was born in 1892. She traveled extensively in the Middle East, beginning when she was 34, and she continued traveling in the Middle East into her late 80s. The title of Jane Jeunesse's biography is Passionate Nomad, The Life of Freya Stark. The book is now available in paperback. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Before we go too much farther and we run the risk of running out of time, maybe you would read from Passionate Nomad to give us a sense of what it was like for this British woman to travel in the Middle East.
Well, I'd love to. I love reading Freya. And do interrupt me, what if I read too long? But I'll try to get a smattering of what it was like to suddenly kerplunk be in this exotic world. In November 1934, the ship bearing Freya down the Red Sea passed through the Gate of Lament, or Bab al-Mandab, the narrow strait that separates Arabia from Africa, and anchored among the dhows in the Aden Harbor. The weather was pleasant and reasonably cool, not like the summer when temperatures can go as high as 120 degrees Fahrenheit, accompanied by such wilting humidity that people unused to it can develop boils and funguses in vulnerable places. She had a touch of dysentery, either from a brief stop in Cairo or perhaps from the ship's galley, but otherwise she felt ready to step out of the modern age of bustle and chicanery into an era of elemental conditions where faithful friendship is jostled by the blackest treachery and the crude facts of a semi-barbaric life are encountered at every turn. This was an English traveler's view of the area in 1911. Freya had every expectation that nothing would be terribly different 20 years later, and she relished the prospect. She had prepared carefully. Ever the student, always stern with herself about self-improvement, Freya was elated to find a subject that required reading Herodotus, Strabo, The Periplus of the Erythraean Sea by an anonymous author, as well as Pliny, Claudius Ptolemy, Diodorus Siculus, the Koran, and the Bible. For months, she had studied the Sabian script, the written language of the Kingdom of Sheba. She had done research in London and traveled to Germany to find out what there was at the Munich Institute about Shabwa and the other ancient cities that had been its rivals. She knew that a European man would have difficulty getting into the Imam's kingdom. An unveiled European female would find it impossible. Somehow, though, she must, because on just one side or other of that unmarked fluid border, the violet line, lay Shabwa, her designated trophy. And I should say here that it is in Shabwa where a few weeks ago the Yemeni government, trying very hard now to cooperate with the United States about terrorism in Yemen, It was in Shabwa that they cornered a group of supposed al-Qaeda operatives, and they had a wild shootout. And again, following in Freya's footsteps, I have been to Shabwa, and let me tell you, it is one very lonely place in the southern tip of the empty quarter. Quite fascinating that it is now, this forgotten place is now playing a new role. Assumed, and I will continue if I may.
Sure.
Assumed to have been a trading station from the beginning of time, Shabwa lay deep in the desert that began at the western extremity of the Wadi Hadramaut, a 350-mile-long valley embraced by massive plateaus and filled with verdant fields of date palms and alfalfa. The Wadi was the longest and most fertile valley in Arabia, dividing the Indian Ocean from the barren wastes of Arabia's empty quarter. Wild frankincense dotted its rocky eastern hillsides, and ancient irrigation systems captured water from the seasonal monsoons. The towns of the Hadramaut were now dominated by two tribes, the Kuwaiti and Kathiri, whose keen rivalry, Freya would discover, kept the small number of British officers posted in Aden busy maintaining peace. And they are still trying to do that, I should add. If she could get to Shabwa, Freya wondered if she might find evidence of the vast treasure said to be buried in its ruins. The site had been the secret object of every explorer ever to penetrate southern Arabia, and there were not very many. Bedouin reports confirmed the city's existence, drifted over with sand, and fiercely guarded by a tribe whose only livelihood was the salt mines nearby, and Freya wanted desperately to be the first to reach it. Excitedly, she wrote a friend, Venetia, "If I do succeed, it will lift the veil off quite a big little corner of historical geography." Mm-hmm. And then I will skip to, most useful of all were the two introductions Freya carried to a remarkable Frenchman in Aden, Antonin Bess. One had been given her by her La Mortela neighbors, the Herbert Oliviers. The other, to Freya's delight, had come from Lady Allenby herself. In all the region of the Indian Ocean, there was no one more influential than this tycoon who had built a trading empire that stretched from Abyssinia to East Asia. Volatile, cunning, an aesthete, devoted to physical exercise, demanding of his family and European employees to the same degree that he was sympathetic to and supportive of his native workers, he dominated the community of Aden and anything and everyone he came into contact with. Bess was 57 and married for a second time in 1934 when he and Freya met. She was 41. Having made a fortune in part through his first wife's money, Bess had divorced in 1921 and married his children's governess, Hilda Crowther, a Scotswoman, who was away when Freya arrived in Aden in December. Half a head taller than her husband, Hilda quickly became the linchpin in his life, as Freya would learn to recognize. Hilda understood Bess's genius, his voracious desire to be loved, and his need to dominate. She blinked at his minor affairs with secretaries and helped the company steer through the upheavals caused when Bess dazzled the young male executives with his charm and personality and then invariably grew disenchanted with them and fired them. He was subject to fits of depression, but also of vast generosity that created medical clinics for his workers, schools for Arab children, and ultimately, St. Anthony's College at Oxford University. Bess was enormously admired by the Arabs when he died in 1951. The shops of Aden had closed spontaneously. Bess was powerfully built, shortish, with slightly receding thick gray hair and a mustache. He served excellent wine at dinner, wore a very thin gold watch, and was always meticulously groomed. The English novelist Evelyn Waugh, traveling to Aden in 1931, enjoyed his keen sarcasm as well as the contrast he found in such a complex personality. "They said of him," said Waugh, "that he thrived on risk and had made and lost more than one considerable fortune in his time." When Waugh accepted an invitation for a little walk on the rocks, he was unprepared for the test Bess would put him to and wrote an amusing account of it, disguising Bess as Monsieur Leblanc. Said Waugh, he looked magnificent. He wore newly creased white shorts, a silk openwork vest, and white espadrilles laced like a ballet dancer's around his ankles. He held a tuber rose, sniffing it delicately.
And what was his relationship to Freya Stark?
Well, that is a tale.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us.
All right.
Let's go and take that call, and then we'll come back to that question.
Sure.
Our listener is in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. I had a question about whether Freya Stark has she been critiqued in any way by the critique of Orientalism as a woman, as someone who's an autodidact, Did she have any original views of the Middle East? I mean, was she sort of influenced by all the previous people who'd been to the Middle East, and therefore see the Middle East through that prism, or was she able to get beyond that?
It's a very good question, and I think the answer would be that she was ambivalent. Yes, indeed, Freya was a product of her time, her era, and Edward Said's remarkable Orientalism, with which you're obviously familiar, which criticizes the traditional way of looking at the Arab in a sort of over-romanticized but ultimately
degenerate,
contemptuous, manner. And so Freya, she did consider herself an imperialist, but she considered herself a better sort of imperialist. But she did believe in the enormous imperial role of the British.
And the superiority of their civilization.
Yes, except, can I read you one little quote?
Sure.
It's quite nice, and it's about diversity, and boy, do we need to think about that these days.
Mm-hmm.
She said at one point, "Such delicate goods as justice, love, and honor, courtesy, and indeed all the things we care for, are valid everywhere. But they are variously molded and often differently handled, and sometimes nearly unrecognizable if you meet them in a foreign land. And the art of learning fundamental common values is perhaps the greatest gain of travel to those who wish to live at ease among their fellows."
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice,
yes,
because that's what we all need to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I mean, yes, she was a product of her era, and she was not cutting edge.
Right.
She was not an anti-imperialist.
But did she ever work for the British Empire, or was she merely using her inheritance to travel around and using people?
She was sustained by her inheritance and by the money she made from her books. But she also, in the Second World War, did have a role, and she was, for a time, in the diplomatic service. And she set up, because she knew so much about the secret Muslim Brotherhoods, about the beginning with the assassins, mm-hmm, and the Muslim Brotherhood and so forth, she was able to set up a propaganda mechanism for the British that was pro-British. Because if you remember, the Arabs were sick to death of the French and the British and the West.
Right.
They were quite attracted to the Germans, who were busy blandishing them.
Right, so she could kind of understand where they were coming from and what might appeal to them.
Yeah, so she was trying to create some mechanism for enlisting the sympathies of the Arabs for the Allied side against the against Hitler and the Nazis.
Right,
and it was something called the Ikhwan al-Haraya, and it
Brothers of Freedom.
Good for you. And it was exactly, we must talk about this. Anyway, it became so successful, and it grew exponentially, as, you know, Osama bin Laden's terrorist cells have done as well,
mm-hmm,
that it had to be suppressed by Nasser himself, of course, a product of the Muslim Brotherhood.
But these were people that were pro-British.
I'm sorry?
Ikhwan Huriya, whatever you said,
yes,
were pro-British, that she had created them in sort of...
Yes.
She had,
But somehow they
didn't agree with Nasser, so they had to be put down.
That's right.
Because
at bottom, Nasser was very anti-British, feared that they could be a force against his own regime.
But were they also very religiously inclined, or were they...
I think less so. I don't think it was nothing that happened in the Muslim world.
They were being more towards liberalism or something.
That's right. They were embracing Jeffersonian principles.
Mm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, I'm delighted with your question.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. I'm so glad we got to that. And we're here at the end of time. Very quickly, we left an area of inquiry on the table. And just to wrap up there with answering sort of that question, maybe we should refocus the question or refocus our attention. And just briefly, if you might, just offer us your assessment of her romantic life, and in the end, she didn't marry until she was 54, which I think if she had married when she had been young, her life would have probably been very different. But anyway, marriage was something she always desired, but it never worked out until it was quite late, and then it really didn't work out either, and we'll have to just leave that laying there, I'm afraid. But
how discreet you are.
Your thoughts, your comments.
About Freya's emotional life?
Yeah.
Well, I think, as we said earlier in the program, that this trauma at a formative age influenced her a lot in her ability to relate to people and trust people. And I think also the, you know, unresolved issues with her parents, who were at war all the time, affected her ability to trust men. So it is true that when Freya finally did marry, and she did have lots of emotional attachments, but when she finally married, she chose an Erebus, a great friend, somebody who shared all of her interests, but who was gay. And it was and she didn't treat him very well. And I think one of the nicest chapters in my book is the chapter that describes their relationship. And it comes directly from his letters to her and her letters to him that had been sealed. And anyway, we opened them up, and there was this remarkable account of his trying his very, very best. His name was Stuart Perrone. He tried his very, very best to change his nature for her, because he admired and loved her, and he couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And it's a searing insight into the relationship of a gay man and a woman who's determined to change his nature.
Yeah, so sad for both of them.
Truly sad.
We're out of time. In fact, we've strayed beyond our time. I want to thank you so much, Jane, for joining us this afternoon.
I loved it. Thanks for that.
You're very welcome. Jane Jeunesse has been our guest this afternoon. She's the author of a biography of Freya Stark, the title Passionate Nomad, The Life of Freya Stark. The book is now available in paperback from the Modern Library.